There's a cute little story I came across as I started to begin to plot this sermon about 3 or 4 weeks ago. A man walked up to the reservations desk at a large city airport, and the clerk asked him immediately a very simple question: "Do you have any reservations?" Without even a pause, the man said, "Oh, I have tons of reservations, but I'm going to fly anyway." Whenever Joel invites me to fill in for him when he's away, that line reflects more than you know or even can imagine about where I come from in my own struggle with my understanding of God and the faith that guides me. For faith to me is not something that happens immediately in your life. It is a journey. It is an ongoing factor in life as you encounter the lives of so many different people, as you experience what life is all about. Your faith must change and grow and go beyond where it starts out. But there's another side of the coin. The story that I've often told about myself is that a number of years ago, I conducted a funeral and a graveside service at First United Methodist Church. And we assembled at the entrance to the cemetery, and I had my own car, so I followed the funeral director into the cemetery to the gravesite, and we did our thing at the gravesite, and I shook hands with everybody, greeted them all at the conclusion of the service, got back into my car, and began to drive away. Seems like a simple operation, right? Well, first of all, I was in a part of the cemetery I'd never been in before. I had no idea as to how to get out of that cemetery. So I began to drive my car out of what I thought was out of the cemetery, and I look in my rearview mirror, and I have 9 cars following me. And they had no idea where they were going either. And we drove around the same circle at least 5 or 6 times. And finally, I saw a gardener over to one side, and I said, "Where the heck am I going? How do I get out of here?" And he told me, and we led them out of the cemetery. But why I tell that story is, you know, when I first started into the ministry down in New Jersey as a young man, I pretty well adopted this dress of the time, which was a black suit and a white collar, because in New Jersey, the Catholic Church is so dominant, and everybody knows what a Catholic priest is and what he's like. And if I went in a suit like this and knocked on a door somewhere, they'd think I was a salesman for Fuller Brush or something. So it became kind of common practice down there among my Methodist fellow clergy to dress the part of a priest. But I quickly abandoned that because, frankly, I don't want to be offset that way. I have the same struggles you do. I raise the same questions that you do about what we believe, where we come from, and I don't profess to have all of the answers. But I do have some of them. And those answers that I've determined in my own life may change even more as I get older. But I hope I can help you understand that you have to accept where you are at this point and begin to grow and be nurtured by people around you that you talk to who bring life to you in so many different and varied ways. Back in August, when I last preached in this church, and we did come to church twice since then, so I don't just come when I preach. Heck, I was joking with some of the people when I came in here. Back in August, I addressed the writings in the Apostle Paul, where he emphasizes that nothing in all creation can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. For me, that is the starting point for my faith and my understanding about God. I find a tremendous affirmation here that God is an integral part of our lives and a part of all living things. while acknowledging the great difficulty of finding the words to describe this God, just as Paul did and struggled with his image of what he was talking about, I have come to visualize this God much as Deepak Chopra laid on me one day on a videotape that I had from him, in which he talks about God as being a field of energy that can be tapped into by us, and we can get strength from it. We can get knowledge from it because it's also an information field. And this God is such an integral part of our lives. And I reject any image of God that has him sitting on a cloud somewhere twanging a harp or as a human being, and certainly as a male image. I've always appreciated the fact in this church, when Joel is reading the scriptures, particularly out of the Old Testament, when it talks about God as being he, Joel always changes the word to God. God is not male, he's not female. But the Bible was written at a time when males really dominated everything in life. And females were seen as a quiet appendage over there somewhere that gave birth to children, but that had nothing to do with what was in the child, because that was assumed that was all a male prerogative. Strange, strange world that it was. And we have grown up since then, haven't we? At least I hope we have. But we still have a long way to go in the way we treat and accept and talk to the women in our world. But when, you know, you come to this text for this morning and you reflect back on the life of Jesus, we can understand how Matthew felt it was so important to end his gospel writing with what he had come to understand was, I quote, a moral imperative. Matthew had been exposed to all kinds of stories that were circulating in his day. And you have to remember that he wrote his gospel 40 years after Christ was crucified. Matthew was exposed to stories about how Jesus sat by a well talking to a woman, which was forbidden in his day. He cut across the usual boundaries and the man-made barriers. And it was his intent in his life to always listen to other people. Such an important part of who this Jesus was. Matthew saw this. And as Jesus spoke about letting the little children come to him, and as Jesus spoke about a story of a good Samaritan, or healed the daughter of a Roman centurion, cutting across the social lines of his day, as Jesus reached out to heal the sick and enable the crippled, and in so many ways sought to help people to become all that they could possibly become in this life, it certainly must have seemed very natural for Matthew put into a kind of parable form in which a king's subjects are asking at a final judgment, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and thirsty and a stranger and naked and sick and in prison? And Jesus suggests that the king answers, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these my people, you did it unto me. Powerful words. This moral imperative that Matthew has Jesus present to us has nothing to do with our religious involvement. It has nothing to do with how we retain a certain liturgy in our services, or we light candles in church, or are accepting certain creedal beliefs about Jesus and God, or even visualizing God in certain ways as a man or a woman, or how do we see this God? And if I were to go around this congregation this morning and ask each of every one of you, how do you visualize this God? We would stumble because it is so difficult. Our language does not allow us to express what we felt in our lives about the presence of this God. It, this moral imperative that is laid on us has nothing to do with accepting dictates of religious organizations as to what we must believe or not believe. It has nothing to do with those who would try to tell us what biblical ideas, written 2,000 years ago, still control our lives today. Some do, but not all do. Our world has evolved. For Matthew, this moral imperative placed on us all has everything to do with our ability to see the presence of God in the faces of the poor and the hungry and the strangers and the sick and the imprisoned. It has everything to do with an ability to empathize, to listen to and respect the lives of others, and especially in any kind of need. And if one does not see God in the least of God's people, then it is a lie to say that you have ever seen the face of God at all. Powerful words. Think about that for a moment. I have some real concerns. This is not part of what I wrote down here, so you may hold on for another minute or two. I have some real concerns about the technology and the artificial intelligence that is emerging in our world. And frankly, I still do have some trouble using a cell phone these days. My wife is much more proficient at it than I am. But that's beside the point. The other day we came out of a Target store, and there was a little three-year-old sitting in the basket. His mother was carrying another child, and the father was there and the mother, and they were very happy. They'd made some purchases. And a little three-year-old had in his hand a cell phone and was playing games on it. At 3 years old. We see it in our neighborhood. The kids don't go out to play as much. Some of the kids do, but not all of them. Some of them sit there at video games constantly. They're self-absorbed in these things. And the thing that really struck me a number of months ago, we were having some trouble with our cable system at home. And the gentleman from Time Warner Cable came by, and I found those people to be much more open to talking and listening to people these days. But anyway, in the course of his stumbling through the wires in our ceiling down in our cellar, and pulling them down and trying to find the amplifier that he was looking for to replace, he was telling me that he sits on a committee where they interview new employees for Time Warner Cable. And he says, you know our biggest problem? 60% of the people, the young people that come in to look for a job, we cannot hire because they don't look me in the eye. They have no ability to associate with what it means to relate with real people. Now that's a condemnation of what is happening in our society. And we really need to think seriously about what we're doing. I frankly believe that the role of the church should be more to put away those dang things, get them out of our lives, and help people to relate better to one another. And we don't always relate well to each other. We know that. You don't sit on an official board meeting or an administrative board meeting without knowing that sometimes we disagree. But that's perfectly all right. You learn in the process of how to handle some of that thing. And if you are not exposed to that, God help us in terms of what's happening. And they're talking about young girls these days who are committing suicide because of bullying that they experience on these cell phones. They think they've got 5,000 friends out there. They don't have 5,000 friends, my friend. Anyway, that was a side thought I had which struck me. Matthew beautifully put together these words as allegedly spoken by Jesus. They are not unique to all the world's moral imperatives when you think about it. Whether you are Jewish or Muslim or Christian or Hindu or Buddhist, you will come across the feelings that in some way how we treat and listen to other people is the very heart of their religious faith. I found it interesting a few days ago that celebrating Mass with poor people in the splendor of St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Francis denounced those who dismiss poverty as not any of my business, quote, and defined indifference to the needy as a great sin. Pope Francis added, to do no wrong is not enough in life. What is required of us is that we be open to listening to and helping people in times of their need to whatever extent we possibly can. Just like the gentleman who helped the couple across the street down in Great Barrington. It is a moral imperative for all religious people, and particularly for those who call ourselves Christians, since we are called to emulate the love of Christ for all people, especially those who are the lesser in our society. The safety net is one of our country's greatest legacy. And over the years, our people's awakening to the needs of others set the stage for a period of unparalleled prosperity in this country that made this country a beacon to the world. Many ideas were generated in this country that were later incorporated in other countries throughout Europe and Asia, and we never really adopted them, we just talked about them a lot. Our country's awakening began in 1890, can you believe it? As our government passed a Dependent and Disability Pension Act for the Union soldiers who had been wounded during the service. Later, that Disability Act was expanded to include all the soldiers of whatever war we were involved in who had served their country were entitled to a pension. And slowly but surely, as we moved through the 1930s and the terrible years of that depression, Social Security came into being. And without it, 50% of our seniors in this country were living in poverty. And as it came into being and Social Security was provided, I don't think any of them lived particularly overwhelmingly in a wealthy lifestyle, but they certainly do not live so much in poverty anymore. Only less than 10% of the seniors in this country are in poverty. This safety net has been evolving over the years. And what has emerged has been things like Medicare and Medicaid. What's emerged has been all kinds of nutrition assistance programs and food stamps and children's health programs. And sometimes people don't understand as they stand in checkout lines and they see someone paying their bill with food stamps or with some kind of credit card from welfare. And they see that person going out with all kinds of soda pop, and they don't realize that a gigantic bottle of soda costs far less than a gallon of milk. That's often what drives that. We need to listen to people more and condemn people less. And that safety net has evolved even further over the years. The Affordable Care Act was one attempt to try to do something about that. And it tried so hard to recognize that health care in this country should never be something that the wealthy only can afford to do. It should be a right of every citizen of this country. And it was a first step in that Affordable Care Act to make that possible. We need to listen more in this country to the pleas from people in Puerto Rico following that hurricane down there. We need to listen to people who are decrying that they have working something like 50 hours a week and on minimum wages and can barely make ends meet. We need help with college and technical school costs. I often mention the fact that, you sound like an old curmudgeon, I've been around too long. But when I went to college, my tuition for a semester was $150. At an engineering school that gave me an incredible education. $150. Now we're talking what, 20, 30, 40,000 for a year? Maybe 50,000 for a year in some of our schools? People need help. Education is going to be a part of that. Now I'm not trying to stand up here and sound like, I want to blow the budget and everything on all this stuff. And it worries me, frankly, that we might well do some of that. because it could also mean that we end up cutting programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, which have no business being cut. But all I'm pleading for is that we take time out and stop and think about what we're doing with our tax proposals. And in fact, with every step forward into the social safety net, we increasingly hear all kinds of cries, and it's happened every step of the way as things have happened in this country. People will say, well, it doesn't work, or the social safety net traps people in cycles of dependency. And some strongly suggest that money is being wasted. And with respect to women's health issues, there are those who would take us back to a male-dominant world of yesterday and who fail to recognize a world in which one woman in four at the age of 40 has sought after an abortion. That's an incredible statistic. No country can afford to walk away from the people that are referred to in the Bible as the least of these. And that's not a degradation statement, because most of the time it is not anyone's fault that they're in that situation. For people do have real needs. And certainly Christianity and Christian people cannot turn their back on those who struggle. What has been happening in our country? I've suggested a couple of things, but there are so many things going on. Our churches need to continue to do the work they do, and I absolutely am flabbergasted by what South Church is able to do. And I think it's a wonderful thing. But our voice of our churches and all the world's religions must be heard together. A government of the people, by the people, and for the people must honestly deal with the problems that are happening in our country. As individuals, we can only do so much, but a government can dramatically aid financially in that process. The safety net must be expanded to reach out to all of God's people. And people must be taught somewhere along the way to listen to others, to understand the needs of others, to understand that they alone cannot solve the world's problems, but that working together, each of us working together, nothing is impossible to us. That is the moral imperative placed on us by the life of Jesus. We are all clearly responsible for the least of us. The Christian church must come together and lead that way. And the life of Jesus showed us the way forward. Amen.